Hello, welcome to the House of Comments, a podcast about politics. I'm Mark Thompson, an independent commentator and blogger. Apologies, I haven't released one for the last few weeks, but life and various other things have got in the way. But we're back now and should be doing them fairly regularly between now and the general election. And I'm delighted to be joined by Sarah Scarlett, who is a political activist and former Lib Dem. Hi, Sarah.
Hello, Mark.
Hi. Also, should just apologise because we did actually do a recording a few weeks ago, but it all went wrong technically and wasn't able to release it. So although we'll be talking about some different stuff, I think the thing at the end we have already sort of discussed once. So we'll try and resurrect that discussion and remember it as best we can. The first thing we wanted to talk about tonight is tax avoidance stroke evasion, because this was a big story. In fact, it has been a big story over the last couple of weeks, and it's kind of rumbled on, and it feels like it might be one of the defining issues of the election campaign, not least because the way Labour seem to have approached this problem, I don't think the press, especially the right-wing press, are going to let them off the hook, because already we're starting to see stories about, you know, things that Labour donors have done in terms of tax avoidance, and also there's a question mark over how Ed Miliband is going to ultimately inherit the property that his parents owned after his father died, etc. Sarah, what do you think about this? I mean, I suppose the first thing to say is that there is actually a difference between avoidance and evasion, but these two things seem to be conflated these days into just, you know, if you're trying to avoid tax at all, then you're a wrong'un.
Yeah, basically, tax avoidance slash evasion is one of the topics where I think the British public deserve the leadership they get. First of all, tax evasion and avoidance, as you've quite rightly said, they've been conflated and they are not the same thing at all. And I feel like the press and even the British public they get angry at individuals when they shouldn't. You know, I've seen this debate again and again, and, you know, no one mentions, you know, tax code reform. People seem to think that tax evasion slash avoidance is solely the responsibility of the individual who's paying taxes. And, you know, they forget, you know, or they're ignorant of, you know, the way the tax code is. And let's face it, the tax code is a massive, rancid Swiss cheese. And it's got all these holes in which have been written into the tax code by the politicians over years for their friends to get through. And, you know, then they get upset when individuals who they don't like get through these massive loopholes. And, you know, getting through loopholes in the tax code is perfectly legal. It's tax avoidance. They've been put there deliberately for people to get through. And one of the cases I was thinking of was the Gary Barlow case, when what he was doing was completely legal, but having done it, you know, he got, you know, people were, you know, almost a lynch mob going, oh, we must withdraw his OBE. And it's like, well, no, how dare you blame him for exploiting a legal loophole in the tax code? If you have a problem with, you know, there being loopholes in the tax code, why not write to your local politician? And they are responsible for it, and they're responsible for the whole climate of it and the whole environment of it. And I just, you know, I think the British public deserve all they've got. You know, the tax code is a tool of the establishment, and failing to understand, you know, what that means, and attacking individuals rather than a corrupt system, kind of makes me feel, you know, really frustrated about this issue, and it does make me feel like the British public deserve all they get.
Yeah. I'm not totally up on what happened with the Gary Barlow case. Was he one of those people who invested in one of those schemes that was helping out the film industry that the government had specifically brought in?
It was a scheme that was helping out the music industry.
Right.
And it was basically, you know, if you do this set of philanthropy, you know, you pay less tax.
Yeah.
And that was a legal scheme.
But it's more than that. It was legal. It was deliberately brought in by the government in order to stimulate the music industry. And I know there was a similar one for the film industry too, because I think the film industry one, I think that was the one that Jimmy Carr got caught out with. You know, he was then vilified, and then he kind of, you know, very contritely said he was going to pay money back to the Exchequer. But these schemes are brought in order to stimulate parts of the economy. And then suddenly what will happen is the media will get hold of the fact that someone famous has used it in some way. And I think sometimes they're used in the way they were intended. Perhaps sometimes they were used in a way that was not intended, but it's still perfectly legal, because accountants, you know, are paid a lot of money in order to find ways of, you know, structuring someone's finances to take advantage of these things. That's what they do. That's why they're paid so much, and why it's such a lucrative career, precisely because they are experts in this, you know, 12,000 page document, tax code, whatever it is. And I do find it a bit rich that then the same politicians that introduced the legislation, well, they'll jump on the bandwagon when the mob, you know, with the pitchforks and the flaming torches, suddenly decide that someone's wrong to have done what they've done. And, you know, I'll repeat what I said at the start. The avoidance and evasion are constantly elided, so that it's actually implied, it's probably never specifically said, but it's certainly implied that what they've done is illegal, or if it isn't illegal, it should be illegal, and it's almost tantamount to the same thing. And I think that's what frustrates me. And what we've seen in the last couple of weeks from the political dimension is that I get the feeling that Labour think that if they can keep banging on about this issue for long enough, even if some of their senior people and some of their donors are, you know, seen as hypocrites, it will stick more to the Tories than it will to them. So if they can make this general election about this issue, it will damage the Tories more and their cronies and all the rest of it, probably because their donors are probably, you know, worse at tax avoidance, or better, whichever way you want to look at it, than Labour's donors are, and therefore it will be worse for the Tories, which seems like a pretty cynical manipulation of the kind of lowest common denominator politics that you were referring to.
Yeah, I mean, Labour's hypocrisy on this just, you know, flabbergasts me. I mean, you know, Labour is so responsible for this as well during, you know, the Tony Blair years. And it's just, you know, I'm pulling up statistics, you know, what is it? The British tax code is 5 times longer than the complete works of Shakespeare. And I just think that, yeah, it, Labour, I you know, honestly, sometimes I cannot believe that they can go on TV and, you know, criticise the Tories for tax evasion or slash avoidance. When in fact, you know, they are directly responsible for this. And I just, you know, I despair, because I feel like people don't, like Margaret Hodge, I remember when the Gary Barlow thing came out, she was like, this is an outrage, we'll strip him of his OBE. But it's like, you write the tax code, you know, you are responsible for it. And so Ed Miliband, you know, to criticise, thinking that the shit will stick to the Conservatives more than it will to Labour, I think that that is a very dicey gamble to play. It's also, you know, one of the most, you know, dishonest strategies to play. And they're just, it assumes that everyone who's, you know, has a symbiotic relationship with the government, any business that sort of is, you know, indulges in cronyism, has a closer relationship to the Tories than it does to Labour, when in fact, you know, Labour have got a symbiotic relationship with the unions instead of big business in some ways. So they think that the ship will stick more to the Tories than to Labour. And that, I think, is a strategy that I hope, you know, if there's any justice in the world, will backfire in Labour's face. Because they are, you know, this is the same in the States, you know, where the Democrats are like, you know, it's an outrage that the Koch brothers fund the Republican Party, even though the Democrats have their own, you know, little cachet of billionaires who fund the Democrat Party. You know, it's just, Yeah, I mean, it's a barefaced lie. It's one of the parts of politics where it's not just, the usual sort of sins of omission where, one party is sort of, underplaying their role in it. It's an outface lie. And also it distracts from a much worthier topic, which is tax code reform.
Well, that's what I was going to come to actually, because it's all very well politicians and the media banging on about this, but I mean, I've been following politics for more years than I care to remember, and I can't remember a time when some politician somewhere wasn't saying, "We're going to simplify the tax code, we're going to close these loopholes, we're gonna get more money in for the exchequer by reforming the tax code and closing these loopholes." Politicians are always going to do that. I remember Osborne before the 2010 election was another one of these politicians who said that he would simplify the tax code, and I understand it's got even more complicated since. And I think it's partly a function of the fact that although politicians might say they want to simplify things, once they get their hands on the levers, they just can't help but add little tricks and little bits here, and let's just bolt a little bit on here. And I know we said we weren't going to, make modifications, but actually, there's this particular special interest group that I want to give a tax break to here, and we want to change the allowances here, and we'll split this allowance and make it two tier, and we'll change child benefits so that actually, if you're earning over a certain amount, then you can't claim child benefit anymore. Well, actually, you can claim it, but then it'll be clawed back through the tax system, and blah 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 blah. And it just goes on and on and on, and I kind of despair that it will ever really be simplified or reformed in any significant way. Do you think I'm just being too pessimistic there?
Oh no, I despair as well. I mean, and also there is no reason for the tax code to not be 10 pages long. People don't understand that it could easily be, really, really short.
Well,
And
why do you think it isn't? And why, I mean, I assume you agree with me that it never will be. It will never be anything like as short as that. But why not?
well, in my world, it would happily be 10 pages long. The reason it isn't is because it's their toy, and the minute they get the whole their own hands on the toy, once they're in office, what they've said when they're trying to get elected suddenly goes out the window. And that is, there doesn't seem to be any check on that particular power. And the way to completely destroy tax evasion is to make the tax code short and simple and flat taxes flat and low, then they are incredibly hard to evade. And the only way you can, the tax code should be designed in a way that the only way you can evade tax is if you misdeclare your income. So it's fraud as well as tax evasion. And right now, tax evasion slash avoidance is not fraud as well as evadence slash avoidance.
Is that because legally it's so complicated that actually it is a fair defence in terms of the allegation of fraud that you could say that you just literally didn't understand it was too complicated?
Oh yeah. And the fact that, the fact that it needs an army of accountants to work their way through it. Like, I couldn't just pick up the tax code and know what was in it, or know, what to do with it. You need to be a specialist, and that creates deliberate holes to hide in.
Yeah.
So they've done it on purpose, and you can't, it's a, you can't say that it's not a consequence of a corrupt system, yet rather than the individuals who are doing it. And frankly, I actually do have a lot of empathy for people who just say, well, look, the tax code pretty much tells me contradictory things, so I'm going to pay the option where there's the le the least tax, and then I can justify it.
Yeah.
I just completely, I feel like you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't, because I don't, morally, there's nothing morally good or superior about complying with a really corrupt system.
I mean, it's interesting what you've just said there, because I used to run my own company, and so I've had numerous conversations with my accountant about, various things, and also not just to do with running the company, but also my own personal tax affairs as well. Because as soon as you're a director of a company, you immediately have to start filing a, your own tax return. So I had that joy about 10 years ago. I had to start doing. And the amount of times I've had conversations with my accountant where he said, "Well, the situation is this, but actually sometimes it's interpreted like this, and but there's not really any case law on this because it's fairly new, so it might be this, it might be that, and what I would advise is this." And I before, rather naively perhaps, but before I started having to deal with any of that stuff, I just assumed it would all be straightforward and obvious, but it isn't. And therefore, surely that must be a function of the level of complexity that we're dealing with here, that even the people who are, paid and trained to be able to understand this stuff, actually, half the time, don't really know in explicit detail what you should do. And it's almost a kind of, well, we'll try this, and then if you get audited, then maybe, maybe you might have to pay a bit more tax or whatever. And my accountant would usually advise to kind of err on the side of caution, to be fair. But the fact that there was any leeway at all, and that you could go this way, you could go that way, really surprised me.
Yeah, I mean, and there's a whole industry dedicated to, how to navigate this rabbit warren of, something that really can't be understood by a layman. And, and also it is incredibly expensive to collect tax because the tax code is so complicated. If the tax codes were simple, it would be better value for the taxpayer as well. And it is something that is deliberately designed to, I don't know, to screw over people who aren't experts. So that's, anyone who is not a big business, individuals, you are it gives a privileged position to big companies who can afford big accountants. And that's basically it.
I mean, I think, we can, we can probably sleep safely in our beds tonight, because all of the major parties have, pledged that they're going to, close the loopholes and, roll back the tax and everything. So I think after the next election, we'll be fine. Within a few months, I think this will all be sorted out. So I think we can optimistically move on from this topic, whilst I just try and hide the sarcasm in my voice. And the next thing that we wanted to talk about was Peter O'Born. Who is a journalist of some reputation. He's been around for a long time, and he this week resigned as his, or at least it was announced. I think he'd actually already resigned a little while ago, and it had been done on the quiet. But it's been announced that he has left the Telegraph, and his he has given his reason. In fact, it's a very long explanation as to why he wrote an article, and it was published on the Open Democracy website. And basically, it comes down to the fact that he thinks that there is too much influence within the Telegraph, from the advertisers, that they have been able to exert their influence, and the executives of the Telegraph Media Group have responded to that pressure, or so he claims. And it's affected the judgment about stories, especially relating to HSBC. And there was also some question mark over the influence of both the Chinese and Russian governments. And also, rather strangely, I think it was a review of Despicable Me 2, which was a film that came out recently. And there's been allegations. I don't. This wasn't Peter O'Born's allegation. This was someone else. Because as soon as he made allegations, various other people have come out to back him up. And one of them was that that film was going to get, I think, a 2-star review, but it ended up getting a 3-star review after the studio intervened. I mean, we should just point out before we carry on, these are all allegations, and the Telegraph Media Group has actually denied them all. It's actually issued a blanket denial. It hasn't taken each allegation one by one and disproved it, or disproved them, but it has said that it doesn't agree with any of these allegations. I mean, I guess we wait to see whether or not they will come out with a point by point rebuttal eventually. I mean, I think there's two aspects to this, Sarah, I want to talk about. The first one is the specifics of this case, but then perhaps we can broaden it out a bit more to talk about the media in general, because the allegations that have been made, if they turn out to have been true, are part and parcel of a media landscape now that is more competitive and, you know, more fighting for every pound of advertisers' money that newspapers can get. But in terms of this situation, I mean, what do you think about what O'Bourne has said and about, you know, what that might mean for the Telegraph if it turns out that the allegations are true?
Well, I strongly suspect that these allegations may not be, I don't think they're trumped up. I don't know why he has no reason to say any of this if it wasn't, true. I'm inclined to believe these allegations. However, I think it will mean nothing. I think it will be business as usual. Perhaps the Telegraph will watch themselves a little bit, more in the immediate future. I am 100% sure that whatever the Telegraph is guilty of, all the other papers are guilty of too. So that is how I feel about that. And suddenly today I saw an article in the Telegraph about how the Guardian had bowed to advertising pressure from Apple. So they're not going to take it lying down. But I'm sure that this will change everything, nothing at all. I don't think it will have any effect on anything. Even though I am inclined to believe the allegations, I think that is just the world we live in now. And I don't know when the media has ever not had a symbiotic relationship with big business. Has
Well,
ever.
I mean, I don't know. I'm sure you're right in that there's always been this tension between the two. The whole kind of Chinese walls thing that you hear about, you know, that although the advertising department and the editorial department are part of the same company, there is this kind of separation between them, or at least there is a theoretical separation between them. And I think what O'Bourne has been saying, what other people that have come out to say about what's been happening with the Telegraph, they allege, is that those Chinese walls have broken down. And whereas previously it was quite clear, you know, where the line was drawn, it's just been blurred to the point of, you know, where you get situations where, I mean, it was pretty damning evidence from Chris Cook on Newsnight a couple of nights ago, where he had all the newspapers, the front pages of the newspapers from the day after the HSBC scandal broke. And every single one of the major newspapers covered it in a lot of detail on the front page. And the Telegraph had like a couple of paragraphs on, I think, page two. And then by the next day, it was relegated to the business pages, whereas the other papers carried on covering it. I mean, I suppose in a court of law, that would be considered circumstantial evidence. But there was quite a lot of circumstantial evidence that the more and more they went into the allegations that O'Bourne had made. And I think the allegations are that, although there may have previously been pressure, and it might have been that a certain spin or slant on the story might have been a little bit more favourable, you know, previously due to that sort of pressure, and that may even have just been subconscious from, you know, the editorial staff who kind of knew that they were big advertisers. It's gone a lot further now, and it's, you know, getting to the point where they're either not covering stories at all or they're covering them in such ridiculously, you know, a tangential way that it's almost no point in covering them at all. And I guess the allegation is it's getting worse, and it's actually getting a lot worse.
I can absolutely see that. And the only way that I can guess that an organization can, prevent that is by having such a broad, portfolio of advertising accounts that no one advertiser has the, a big stake. But it seems to me that, HSBC, didn't they bail the Telegraph out or something? I heard that Telegraph had debt or something, and that HSBC sponsored them and was so largely responsible for bringing the Telegraph out of financial trouble or something that I've read in glancing. But having said that, I don't think that is something that is unique to the Telegraph. I'm sure that if you probe deeper into the other papers, I don't want to come across as defending the Telegraph. I'm very inclined to believe that O'Bourne's allegations are credible. But I'm not convinced that the other papers are squeaky clean on this.
Okay, I mean, I don't know.
I
don't even know if the allegations against the Telegraph will turn out to have been true. A bit like yourself, I'm inclined to believe O'Bourne. I think he is a very honourable journalist. I've read a couple of his books. He wrote a book a few years ago called I think it was called The Art of Political Lying. And then there was another book it was The Rise of Political Lying, and then there was another book called The Triumph of the Political Class. Both of which are very, very good books. And you know, he showed neither fear nor favour to anyone in those books. So you know, he is the sort of journalist that if he sees something that he thinks is wrong, he will just say it, even if it's to the detriment of his own career. Although Guido Fawkes seemed to think that this was actually a good career move. Maybe for someone with O'Bourne's connections, perhaps people further down the food chain would struggle if they did a kind of whistleblower thing like this. But just to broaden this out a little bit, because I mean, if it is getting worse, then surely a big part of the reason why that is because of the way the media landscape has completely transformed in the last 10 years or so, with the rise of the internet. And it was quite interesting when I was seeing various people from different media organisations being interviewed about this. And one of the people they interviewed was, I think it was BuzzFeed's UK editor. And you know, he was all kind of on his high horse about, you know, they have certain editorial standards and blah, 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 blah. But I was kind of smiling as I was watching this because, you know, BuzzFeed and its ilk are one of the reasons why things are happening like this, aren't they?
Yes, but I think that they sort of, you know, I can't imagine that there's a huge amount of crossover between BuzzFeed's readers and the Telegraph's readers. I don't know if that's just, I mean, I think that's, there's a generational difference. And whilst, you know, one generation, you know, continues to go to the traditional sort of media, a new generation has a new media. And what's wrong with that? And, you know, even if the Telegraph, you know, is, you know, wholly corrupt and in the pocket of its advertisers, so what? There are, you know, literally millions of other places you can get your news from if you don't think the Telegraph is doing it properly. And yeah, you know, in a way that's also a healthy check on the traditional media, as well as, you know, media outlets which cater to a different clientele. So I'm blaming the media landscape probably isn't a good enough excuse for poor morals, but yeah, they've got to adapt to the competition, but I don't know if that's an excuse really.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is though, isn't it, that people now just expect to be able to get news for free. I mean, if I think back to when I was a kid, and actually my family didn't normally have a newspaper, although we used to go around to like relatives who did used to have newspapers. And then when I got a little bit older and when I was studying politics at A level, which would have been early 90s, and I remember one of the things that the teacher said was that you should get a newspaper, you should read, try and read a couple of newspapers regularly. Yeah. But in order to do that, it cost money. You know, I was a student, I didn't have that much money. It was quite tricky. I mean, imagine nowadays, you know, on the syllabus for these things, you know, yeah, you need to read a newspaper, no problem. You just go online and you can read The Independent and The Guardian, and I suppose you can't read The Times without paying now, but you can still read The Telegraph without paying, and so on. And that's a big part of the problem, isn't it? Because people do just expect to be able to get news for free now. It's interesting what you said about a generational thing as well, because I am quite a big fan of Tom Chivers, who was a columnist and journalist for the Telegraph. He was one of the more kind of, I suppose you would describe him as left-wing or maybe progressive voices on the Telegraph staff. But I hadn't seen any of his pieces for a little while since the whole Telegraph blogs thing disbanded. And then I did a Google search for him, and it turns out he's now working for BuzzFeed. And I was looking at some of the articles he'd written, and it's like the 12 most such and such, you know, the five best. So all his pieces are now listicles. Which, you know, kind of demonstrates that, you know, journalists working for one media organisation can very quickly turn their hand to, you know, whichever way the wind is blowing in that respect. But yeah, just coming back to my point about people expecting to get the news for free. I mean, I think this is going to get worse and worse because, as you say, the next generation is coming up. And I bet you very few people in the generation, you know, say 10, 15 years below me, ever buy newspapers now.
Yeah, I mean, I personally don't buy a paper. But
You're probably in that generation I just referred to, actually, Sarah, to be fair.
Yeah, but I do have a subscription to The Telegraph and I use my mum's subscription to The Times. I think it's a little bit strange. I mean, my generation is very guilty of expecting content for free. And to be fair, you know, the Daily Mail doesn't give it to you for free. They've got tons of adverts on their site. Sometimes they have so much advertising, their site doesn't even work on slower computers and slower connections. So I do think that my generation, you know, needs to just accept that you either have adverts or maybe, I don't know, maybe we are happier with adverts. That seems to be the consensus that I get from my my friends, is generally people my age are happier with adverts and not having to pay. And that's certainly, you know, something that Guido has exploited in that he is, you know, his other business is Message Space. And, you know, that's the sort of way you make money out of content, is by through the advertising. And BuzzFeed has, you know, quite a lot of advertising as well. And sometimes their listicles are, you know, sort of seem to be sponsored, if you know what I mean. I've got a BuzzFeed open now. I get the sense that, you know, it's sort of like living content, but also advertising, in that it's sort of a news article about something, which is also sort of advertising it. That's the type of article which I think we'll see more of. But, you know, it's not just the news media who's in the pocket of their sponsors. And I don't know how that can be easily solved. I'm quite surprised that The Telegraph is so beholden to their advertisers, because they do have quite a lot of advertising and they also have a subscription. You can't read The Telegraph unlimited online without paying for it, as well as seeing the advertising. If everyone just puts their foot down, if every media outlet put their foot down and said, you know, you can't have content without paying for it, I still don't think that would solve this problem.
Well, I don't think it would solve it, would it? Because, you know, you've got people like me, unfortunately, who will just put out content for free. I mean, okay, you could argue that I'm quite parasitic in my content, because I will pick up stuff from the mainstream media and what's going on in political debate, and then we'll comment on it. I have broken a few stories myself over the years, but you could probably count on two hands the amount of kind of, you know, original stories I've broken from my own sources, because that's not really what I do. And I imagine there are a lot of people out, well, I know there are a lot of people out there like me, but then there are other organisations like, I mean, we've mentioned him a couple of times now, but Guido Fawkes, you know, is one of those websites that does break news, and that's free. I know he has a column in the Sun on Sunday, and obviously that has to be paid for, both online and if you buy it in print. But, you know, there are lots and lots of sites out there that just wouldn't ever consider charging. You know, there's no way you would ever get this kind of consensus across all media organisations, right? We're all going to suddenly start charging now, because it only takes one or two of them to break that embargo to get the competitive advantage and to get all the click-throughs. So if anything, it's going to go the other way eventually.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, for instance, Guido, you know, relies on advertising a lot, but he's not in any, I don't get the sense that in any way, you know, he is the advertiser's bitch. I can't even imagine that. And I don't know if that's just the persona he he expresses.
Well, actually, it's interesting we keep referring to him as he, and we should stop talking about him in a minute. His ego's big enough as it is. But actually, it's several people. It's basically a media organisation in and of itself. In fact, they've even ditched the word blog from the site in the last few days. So, they've kind of really become one of the big boys now.
And also the fact that he controls his own advertising.
Mm.
And he controls the advertising for a lot of other sites through his second space. And he's really an entrepreneur in that sense. Mm. However, as you pointed out, you know, bloggers do not create original content. Most of the time, they are bouncing off. You know, even people who review, you know, movies, they are bouncing off something that someone else has created. The only sort of, you know, the only original bloggers I think I read are people who have, you know, written their own recipes. You know, people who are commenting on political stories are people who are not creating their own original content, whereas Guido actually is. So he's right to drop the blog label. He's not a blog anymore. He's gone beyond that. He went beyond that a long time ago. I don't know what the answer is to, you know, restoring the credibility of content providers, unless you just, you know, the only news you get is from like Reuters directly or AP, and you just go to their websites and read nothing else. I don't know how we can ever get pure news. I don't know if that's achievable, realistic, or even desirable. Because I don't necessarily view neutral news as the best quality news. You know, sometimes people put a spin on their news and that can still be a better story than, you know, in inverted commas, you know, neutral news story that isn't written very well and is, you know, can be is only tackled half as well. You know, so I'm not someone who believes that neutral news is always the best news. However, I do think, as you said, there's circumstantial evidence that O'Bourne is very right, and is right to tackle these allegations.
Mm. Okay. Right, let's move on to our final topic then. And actually, this is something you wanted to talk about. So, as I mentioned at the start, we have already sort of had this conversation, but it was a few weeks ago. So let's try and recreate the magic. So it's about enlightenment, isn't it? Do you want to set out your thesis? I think that's how we introduced it last time.
Yeah. Well, it seems to me, in my humble thought process, that the world is splitting into people who want to live their lives by enlightenment values and people who do not want to live their lives by enlightenment values. And to just brief that, enlightenment values are things like the notion that the individual owns themselves, and that individuals cannot be slaves or serfs as they were for most of humanity. Most individuals, you know, were not considered, you know, free men. To be a free man was a separate, distinct, higher status than most people enjoyed for most of history. And, you know, there are other values such as freedom of speech is an enlightenment value. It is not a Christian value. It's not a, you know, Abrahamic value of any type. Even vaccinations. Vaccinations started sort of with the Enlightenment. And, you know, now we're even seeing those dispatched.
Oh, don't get me started on that. But anyway, carry on.
Well, it all ties into the same thing. And, you know, what we've seen recently is horrific gun attacks in major European cities such as France, you know, Paris, and just now Copenhagen, and they're both gruesome. And they are both terrorist acts, you know, specifically attacking freedom of speech, and they are attacking the concept and the value of it. And, you know, it seems to me that the world is splitting into people who want to live by enlightenment values and people who don't want to live by enlightenment values. And I get quite upset when people attack or blame Muslims in this country for atrocities, you know, terrorist atrocities that, you know, that are perpetrated by, you know, fanatics. And when you think about it, most, you know, for instance, Muslims in this country have come to the West because they want to live under enlightenment values and for whatever reason they can't do in their own countries. And the people who are rejecting those values are the people who are really in the minority and really angry and isolated. But when people attack Muslims and say Muslims are responsible for these atrocities, well, it's actually incredibly unhelpful, because those who are usually the moderate Muslims are the ones who have made the decision to assimilate and live their lives under the values and the prosperity that the values afford them.
I mean, you've made reference to Muslim extremists and kind of religious extremists as well. I mean, I think what I find quite interesting in this debate, we had Ian Dunt from politics.co.uk on a few weeks ago. We were talking about, it was just after the Charlie Hebdo shootings. And we were talking about how, he pointed out actually that the worst terrorist atrocity that's happened in Europe in recent years was Anders Breivik, who wasn't religious. Isn't religious. In fact, it was sort of ideological, because it was sort of a far right ideology. But really, if anything, he was more just identified by the fact that he was a bit of a loner, really, and a bit weird. And we've seen other terrorist attacks like that over the years. I mean, I'm thinking of Timothy McVeigh, the Oklahoma bomber. There are lots of terrorist attacks that happen all around the world, over the years. And yes, some of them have been committed by Muslims. But actually, quite a lot of them have been committed by other people under different umbrellas and for different reasons, sometimes ideological, sometimes not ideological at all. And I think it is quite interesting that, the ones that are committed by Muslims seem to be the ones that are most focused on. But I suppose what I was going to ask is, do you think that the specific kind of anti-enlightenment angle that you're referring to here is really only perpetrated by religious extremists? Or do you think it goes more broadly than that? Because you alluded to vaccinations, and I don't necessarily think some of the people who aren't vaccinating their children are religious or doing it for religious reasons. Some of them are, but plenty of them aren't doing it for religious reasons, for example.
But one of the key points of the Enlightenment was, scientific reason over, religious doctrine. And it seems as though these people have capitulated to sort of pseudoscience / spiritual, misguidance, rather than referring to the science.
Well, there's a kind of anti-intellectualism abroad that I've detected over the last few years.
Yes.
In that it's almost seen like, well, what do the scientists know? What do they know? What do these people in the white coats know? As if it's almost like they view science like a form of religion, in that it's kind of, just dictated on tablets of stone from on high, rather than a rigorous process that goes through and does, double blind, randomized controlled trials and actually finds out what works and what doesn't work. And then that's what they, that's what they try and give people, such as with vaccinations or with drugs and stuff. It feels to me like there are too many people who either don't understand that process or kind of willfully refuse to understand that process and think that their own emotion and their own gut feelings about something, you're not going to stick a needle in my child, and what about all these toxins that are in the vaccines and stuff, that somehow that trumps actual scientific evidence.
Yeah, it's very strange. And as I said, this sort of scientific reason came up during the Enlightenment, and also the trying to get rid of superstition was a long fight. But they've seemed to have, I don't think they realise the process, and the fact that, libertarians in the United States criticise the FDA because they test, potential vaccines and medicines for such a long time and delay them from the market lest they, cause any harm, that they actually say that this process, they test them too much. and that they could have saved lives by bringing these drugs to the market, you know, 2 years sooner. And so, yeah, there's a whole group of people which is saying, you know, these drugs are tested, you know, and prevented from, you know, getting to the market, you know, for far too long. And then you have another group of people who are saying, absolutely not, you cannot touch my child with this disease, you know, with these, not this disease, these vaccines to prevent this disease. And one of the most stark things which pretty much drove this home was someone, a doctor on Twitter said, someone came into my office and asked for an Ebola vaccine, and he offered them a flu vaccine instead, and they said, oh, we don't believe in that. And when I don't think that people realize in Europe that people used to die just like they're dying of Ebola in Africa, of other diseases that we don't even have now, you know, smallpox and things like that. And also, I remember I grew up in the third world, and my siblings and I had to have more vaccines than the children in the West and the children, you know, our counterparts in the UK. And, you know, we were, because the threat of getting diseases was so much more imminent, any parent would have been, you know, considered a reckless, you know, would have been shunned, and you probably wouldn't have been able to put your kid into the type of schools I went to in Dubai had you not had a certain level of vaccinations, and had, you know, we had to hand in our vaccination cards. And I just, the fact of the matter is, vaccinations are the most successful public health initiative ever conceived and brought into action. And I, you know, I'm flabbergasted by parents who are choosing not to vaccinate their kids. And, you know, again, with the autism thing, you know, even if, I don't think vaccinations cause autism.
Well, I mean, there's pretty much as close as you can ever get to scientific proof that it definitely doesn't.
Yeah, we can pretty much say that it doesn't. But even if it did, because the rate of autism is so tiny, you know, I don't think it would be worth not vaccinating my child, you know, because your child could end up with autism and measles, you know, your child could end up with, you know, tuberculosis and and autism, you know, that was the reality in the Middle East. So I, you know, it's inconceivable and irrational that parents are shunning away from, you know, vaccinating their kids from diseases which aren't, you know, eradicated yet. You know, okay, nobody's got to be vaccinated against smallpox anymore because we've eradicated it, but we clearly haven't eradicated measles.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, the children are suffering from their parents, you know, misjudgment on this. And a lot of people ask me, as a libertarian, would you make, you know, vaccines compulsory? And I'm flabbergasted that I would need to say, you know, to answer that question. And I'm almost, it's one of those things which really tempts me to say yes.
And you see, that's a really interesting point, because the more that the sort of stuff that you're hearing about vaccinations has become more and more prevalent over the last few months and years, that question did actually occur to me a few weeks ago. I did start to wonder about the, you know, the kind of the extreme libertarian perspective would be that it's entirely down to the individual and it shouldn't be up to anyone else to tell you what you should do.
Yeah.
But this is one of those situations where it's like a natural, almost kind of socialized thing, isn't it? Whereby once you get the herd immunity above 90 or 92 or 95%, depending on what the disease is, it becomes a social good for everyone to have that level of herd immunity. But if you give enough people, or everyone, the choice of whether you can either have this or not, and too many people choose what I would really say is the wrong choice, which is to not have your child vaccinated, your child might get away with it. But what about all the immunocompromised children who can't have vaccinations, or the ones who are too young to have the vaccinations, so they're relying on the herd immunity? And it then becomes an incredibly selfish and actually ultimately sociologically dangerous thing to do.
Yeah.
So I can understand, because I know that you've got pretty strong libertarian credentials, but I'm pleased to hear you've been agonising over this question, because it isn't actually a straightforward one, is it?
It's not. I mean, and you know, there's one actress who is, I think it's Kristen Bell, I'm not sure, I might be wrong on that, but she said that children who aren't vaccinated can't play with her children. And I think that this is the route that we have to make it socially unacceptable not to vaccinate your children any, you know. And I don't know why, you know, if you believe in not vaccinating your children, then I don't know why you shouldn't be allowed to send your kid to, you know, a state-funded school. That's how I sort of feel about it.
Mm. But that's almost making it mandatory in this country, at least for most people who can't afford private school.
If you want to live outside sort of that type of, if you want to live with those thoughts outside of the normal, then you have to educate your children outside of the norm. That's sort of how I feel about it. I would be uncomfortable. I don't have kids, but I'd be uncomfortable sending them to school with a whole bunch of, you know, 50% of kids are vaccinated, 50% are not. It's sort of like reverse Darwinism, isn't it?
It's interesting. Now, you know, we'll have to wrap this up pretty soon. We're actually starting to stray into kind of conspiracy theoryism here, aren't we? Because I think one of the reasons why quite a lot of the parents who refuse to vaccinate their children give, or even if they don't give it, they probably secretly harbour, is that, you know, it's all about Big Pharma and they're putting too many toxins in, and actually measles isn't that dangerous a disease anyway, and it's all down to the government trying to control what we do with our own children and blah, all of that stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it's interesting that, you know, the same sort of websites and, you know, prominent people in the media like your Ikes and your Alex Joneses, you know, InfoWars and all of that stuff, the you know, it almost seems like being anti-vaccine is like almost a semi-respectable, you know, it's almost like the middle class semi-respectable end of conspiracy theorism, you know. And but then obviously you get the more extreme end where, you know, you get people who don't believe we landed on the moon and don't believe that 9/11 was perpetrated by the people that, you know, everyone else thinks perpetrated them, and so on. There's actually a really interesting book I read by David Aronovich a couple of years ago called Voodoo Histories, which actually goes into the history of conspiracy theories, and it picks out about 10 of the best and kind of goes into a lot of detail about them. And I guess that kind of comes full circle back to what you were talking about at the start about, you know, enlightenment, because, you know, I don't get me wrong, like, I understand that there are some people out there who probably genuinely believe some of these conspiracy theories and quite happily go about their daily lives, you know, in normal society. But it's, you know, it's one of these things where really rational thought processes largely have to go out of the window if you're going to believe a lot of the mumbo jumbo that, you know, some of these conspiracy theorists come out with. And that is anti-intellectual, and it's anti-enlightenment, isn't it? It's going against all of that progress that we've made over all of those years. I mean, most people probably don't understand what Occam's razor is, but I really wish more people did, because really it just boils down to, you know, the most likely explanation for something is the simplest one, and it almost always is the case. You know, rather than Princess Diana was assassinated by, you know, however many different shadowy cabals who, you know, planned this and planned that and managed to time it perfectly, and no. The driver was pissed and he crashed into underneath a river in Paris. You know, that's the most obvious and likely explanation. And I would be utterly astounded if it turned out it was something else. And it's the same with all of these things. And yet I think some people just don't think like that. And it does seem to be kind of rolling the clock back to the kind of superstitions that you were referring to earlier.
Yeah, and what gets me is if there are these all-powerful, all-knowing organizations, and, you know, if, you know, Bush did 9/11, you know, if he was that good, if he was good enough to pull that off, you know, explain his other behavior in his presidency, you know, if there is some, you know, these genius organizations who are all-powerful and run our lives, you know, explain, you know, where they are, what they were doing, you know, when we needed them to do other stuff, and what. So we've got these all-knowing, all-powerful organizations who do stuff, but they only do weird, you know, bad stuff. Why do they not, you know, you know, are they the ones who are responsible for all progress in our lives? You know, what, where are they? You know, something that conspiracy theories always get, you know, my main argument to against conspiracy theories is, do you really believe that government is that competent?
Well, it's not just, excuse me, it's not just government. It's, you know, it's basically any organisation of people. Sometimes I wonder, people who believe conspiracy theories, have they ever actually lived in the real world? Have they ever actually been in an organisation, part of an organisation, worked for a company, dealt with a local council, dealt with, you know, local government in any way, dealt with any corporations? You know, is it cock up or is it conspiracy? I would say 99.99999% of the time it's cock up when something happens or something goes wrong or something bad happens. It's just accidental. And I think Aronovich puts his finger on this in that book I referred to, that people would prefer to believe that there are shadowy people controlling these things and making the bad things happen than it's just random happenstance, because in a way, random happenstance is actually scarier than the idea that there are some people controlling it and making things happen. Because at least if you believe that there are, you know, people working behind the scenes, you know, kind of puppeteers making things happen, at least there is a chance that you can kind of hold them to account and, you know, find out why they did it and stop them from doing it again. Yeah. If it's just random, as let's face it, it is, then there isn't anything that you can do to stop these things. And that's a very uncomfortable thing for people to admit to themselves.
I mean, yeah, but how uncomfortable is the world in which Bush did 9/11? You know, do you really want to believe that we've got a that the Americans had a government that just randomly killed 3,000 people? Isn't that a more disturbing reality than, you know, this just happened by terrorists?
It's more disturbing to me, but I think the kind of mindset that we're talking about here is one that would prefer there to be someone in control and no one in control. And maybe that also kind of links back to, you know, what you were talking about. You know, some of the people who perpetrate these terrorist atrocities are doing so because they think they're doing it, you know, in service of some higher power. And that, you know, that's, you know, what they're working towards and what they're living for. And I suppose it's like it's a different spin on the same thing. People who believe in conspiracy theories, because, you know, they believe in a higher power. They just believe that that higher power is George Bush and he's corrupt and that we need to do something about him. Well, yeah. Well, he's not even in power anymore, so, you know, they've got their way in the end. But they've moved on now. You know, now they think it's Obama.
Whoever the president is, is in charge of this shadowy cult.
Yeah.
And yeah, it, you know, it just doesn't exist. You know, because can you imagine a group of people getting together, sitting around a table, and saying, "Right, we're going to kill Princess Diana. This is how we're going to do it." What? You know, there's no.
I think there was. I think there was a Mitchell and Webb sketch. We'll have to wrap this up in a second. But I think there was a Mitchell and Webb sketch where they actually sat down and tried to plan how they would have faked the moon landings, and they worked out it was going to cost them more to fake the moon landings than it would to actually go to the moon. You know, and I mean, obviously that's a comedy sketch, but I think there's a lot of truth in that sort of thing. It would have just been, how many people would have had to have been roped in to fake the moon landings and to have carried it off, and none of them ever, ever, ever said anything or released any information about it. All the tens of thousands of people that would have had to have been complicit in it.
All of the new secular superstitions.
Yeah.
It's very disturbing.
Yeah. Well, that was a very interesting discussion. It's kind of taken a bit of a different tangent to, I think, when we discussed it last time, but it's been equally interesting. Maybe if we get one again, we can talk about the same subject and we'll end up in a different place again. All right. Well, thanks very much for your time this evening, Sarah.
My pleasure. That was very interesting.
Yeah. Very interesting indeed. And I'd just like to thank Audio Boom, who very kindly hosts the podcast for us on the internet. And I'd like to thank Kevin McLeod at incompetech.com for our theme music. And we'll be back soon.